Welcome to The Signal. I'm Dominique Gamet.
And I'm Abigail Trevino. We're with the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism.
Today on the show, concerns about irresponsible drivers in Halifax.
But if you're eating soup from a bowl, how do you do that and drive?
We'll hear from a woman who was almost hit not once, but twice at the same crosswalk.
And keeping the climate change movement going.
The kind of long-term activism that is required for like institutional change.
One group thinks community is the answer.
Plus later, our feature interview with a woman who knows firsthand the distress caused by an eating disorder.
Eating disorders seem to really take control and take the steering wheel of your life.
All that and more on today's show.
Gemma Lee uses the crosswalk at the same intersection every day on her way home from work. At least, she did until recently. The Halifax woman was nearly hit by cars twice in 2 weeks at the intersection of Bayers Road and Joseph Howe Drive. Now, she's raising alarms about reckless drivers in the city. I met with her at the crosswalk. She's calling it danger to pedestrians. Gemma Lee says both times she was nearly hit, she was on the crosswalk and had the right of way. She'd looked both ways to make sure there were no cars. But still, she was almost mowed down.
I actually just froze like to the spot because I couldn't go anywhere. So yeah, I didn't really know like what to think. I was just a bit confused initially. I was like, oh my gosh, I was nearly hit.
After the second close call, she changed her route home to avoid the intersection. Lee is writing to complain to her local counselor, and she now wears a flashing LED safety light. But she thinks the onus is on drivers to be more careful.
I am 6 foot. I'm a tall human, so I should be easy to spot anyway, but there we are.
Tristan Cleveland is an urban planner at Dalhousie University. He thinks bad street design is more to blame than drivers themselves.
It doesn't need to be designed like a race course, which is really what it is right now. Some of the crossings on that road are just absolutely dangerous.
Cleveland says the Bayers Road intersection is particularly unsafe because the speed limit is 50 kilometers an hour. Too high for an intersection that gets so much foot traffic. He also points out the long distances between sidewalks and overly wide streets that allow cars to whiz through.
It is a basic human right that every single one of us needs to be able to walk outside our home and feel comfortable walking to anything that we may need to be able to do.
Sean Cleary agrees. He's the counselor for the area. He says he has a binder several inches thick with all the complaints he's received about reckless drivers. He says he himself was almost hit while walking his dog.
I've heard from several of our police in the traffic unit. And they have seen, you know, obviously tons of people holding their phone up while they're driving. But they've seen things like people with hair dryers and brushes driving with their knee on the wheel, drying their hair and styling it as they drive. People eating soup out of a bowl.
Cleary says the answer is a bit more complicated than just enforcing traffic laws. He says part of the problem is the increasing numbers of vehicles on the road as people move to the suburbs. And he says the city would need provincial approval to lower the speed limit.
It's like an octopus. There's so many tentacles that are out there and trying to look at every single part of the solution.
A city committee is working on a report to identify the top 10 worst intersections. But any changes are months away.
Over the past year, people have come out in the hundreds and sometimes thousands to call for action on the climate crisis. Protests, demonstrations, and ceremonies seem to galvanize people. But when the placards and chanting are gone, some wonder what's happening to the momentum. Amy Brierley visited one group that's trying to keep it alive.
Carolyn Jones was one of thousands who took part in the climate march in September. She continues to work on climate issues with a Dalhousie student society. Still, she says it's hard to keep up the energy between events.
A lot of the time it tends to disappear from people's minds. It's way easier to get someone to come out to an event than it is to create the kind of long-term activism that is required for like, institutional change.
She says the momentum gets lost in classes, jobs, and daily responsibilities. Some people think the answer lies in building community. Recently, about 100 people got together to find ways to support one another in the climate movement. Tanette DeVoe helped organize the event at St. Margaret of Scotland Anglican Church.
I think there really are a small number of people doing the actual organizing in town, and they're getting tired, and they need some reinforcements.
At first, DeVoe planned to hold the meeting in her house, but numbers quickly ballooned. Erica Steele was there. She says events like this help her to be involved in a bigger way.
I think coming together in community is huge because, again, you have your own idea of how you can create change, but if you come together, you hear so many different worldviews. You get to learn a bit about other people's experiences.
Christopher Giroux has been voting for the change he wants to see, but feels like it's no longer enough. It was his first time at a gathering like this.
It was really nice to be surrounded by people who felt the same way. It was nice to be open about the issues. And never once when I was talking to someone about something did I feel that they felt differently. And I thought that was really nice.
DeVoe says she can feel the energy that's grown from the event.
You can become sort of drained and exhausted and discouraged. And then all of a sudden you walk into a hall like this and you're like, wow, I'm not alone.
For Carolyn Jones, it's efforts like this that make big change possible.
It's not possible for a single human being to overcome the kind of issues that are being faced. It's only possible through communities coming together.
No more coal, no more oil, keep your carbon in the soil!
The group plans to meet monthly and bring new people into the fold. For The Signal, I'm Amy Brierley.
An eating disorder can take over your life and turn every meal into a challenge. And almost 1 in 10 people will experience an eating disorder during their lifetime. That's according to a group called Eating Disorders Nova Scotia. Chastity St. Louis is a member who's speaking out about her experience with the condition and the importance of talking about it. Hello, Chastity. Welcome to The Signal.
Hi.
We really appreciate you coming in. So what led you to a place where you could speak openly about having had an eating disorder?
I think this has been a process because I was at my sickest when I was in grade 12, when I was 17 years old, and now I'm 31. So it's been a while now, over 10 years, and every time I talk about it, it becomes a bit more comfortable. At first, I wasn't as comfortable sharing that I had an eating disorder or that I was in recovery from one because it still felt very raw. But now as time goes on and the more that I share my story, the easier it gets.
So can you tell us a little bit about that story?
So most of my childhood and teen years, I was overweight. And I think that is what the decision to go on a diet was what led to the development of my eating disorder. So that's how it kind of began for me, because I think we grow up in a culture that has so much weight bias and stigma. And other factors in my life as well were that I didn't have a lot of friends at that time growing up in junior high and high school especially. So I was kind of at a very lonely place in my life. And once I started going on a diet and losing weight, I received tons of compliments, as people are likely to do when someone starts losing weight. They think, oh, this is great. Like, I need to compliment them. And I think sometimes people treat like weight loss as if it's the most important thing a person can do. I thought was one of the factors that pushed me to want to keep losing more weight. And I think when you start depriving your body and your brain of food, it becomes more difficult to rationalize and realize that I wasn't eating enough, that my weight loss was becoming dangerous and problematic. And when you're caught up in it, you don't realize how the rest of the world might perceive you or how dangerous it is. People can have disordered eating habits at no matter what shape or size their body is, and no matter what gender or sexual orientation it's across the board. So.
Are you comfortable saying which eating disorder you personally dealt with?
Yes, I had anorexia. So, yeah, it started off as a diet, and then I gradually eliminated more and more food and got sicker and sicker, and I didn't really realize it at the time.
So it's been said that an eating disorder isn't something you're cured of. It's something that you learn to live with. Would you say that that's accurate?
I think it really depends on the person and most importantly, what your definition of recovery looks like. So I've found that in recent years, I do feel like I'm moving and taking steps toward actually feeling more fully recovered because for many years, I looked physically well, like that nobody would look at my body and say that this person is disordered, but mentally I still struggled a lot with my body image and certain food rules that I still kind of had, or the thoughts for sure. I think at least my experience has been, and I think a lot of people can relate as well, that the physical aspects are easier to heal than the mental aspects that tend to linger. So it's important to keep the focus on the mental health aspect as well as the physical recovery, because that is probably what I think takes the most work. I think being physically well is that your body is no longer in starvation, and that definitely has a huge impact on someone's mental health, because when your body is starved, your brain can't function properly to rationalize and realize what the eating disorder is and what it's doing to you.
So these days you're doing volunteer work with Eating Disorders Nova Scotia. What do you do exactly there?
This year I've been involved with the planning of Eating Disorders Awareness Week, and in March I'll be training to be a peer mentor myself. So,
what's the value of designating a week around eating disorders?
I think like most mental illnesses, eating disorders aren't something that gets regularly spoken about, and it's not necessarily something that's in the public consciousness that people might not be aware of. I think most people know that eating disorders exist, but they might have misinformation about them. And I think having Eating Disorders Awareness Week helps people, may help someone recognize if they need help or if someone in their lives need help as well. And it helps people know that there are services like Eating Disorders Nova Scotia that are there for help and support. So just to bring some awareness and help maybe plant the seed of recovery for someone out there who is struggling as well.
So what advice do you have for someone who has or has had an eating disorder?
Something that I have said to others who I know are struggling is that it's a lot better on the other side. It's hard to see sometimes when you're in that place where you're sick, but now being more recovered, I feel like I can fully participate in my life again. And yeah, that recovery is very difficult, but it's hard, but it's worth it. So it's so worth it to have your life back, because eating disorders seem to really take control and take the steering wheel of your life, where you're not the, where you're kind of the passenger, that it's the eating disorder in the driver's seat. So you have to kind of take the wheel again, and then you'll be in more control of your life again, which is ultimately the goal.
And what resources are there out there for people who decide that they need and want help?
So there are therapists and Eating Disorders Nova Scotia as well that people can turn towards. So Eating Disorders Nova Scotia has peer mentors and groups and also online forums where people can go to for help as well.
Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Chastity St. Louis is a volunteer with Eating Disorders Nova Scotia. On Monday, the organization is having an online session on identifying and challenging diet culture. The event starts at 7 p.m. You can find out more about that and other events on their website, eatingdisordersns.ca.
You're listening to The Signal, stories from the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism. I'm Dominique Amit.
And I'm Abby Trevino. Still to come on the show, a love letter for Sandy Lake.
If we don't keep the chainsaws out and we don't keep the bulldozers out, we're going to lose once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Local conservation groups are crafting Valentines with a political edge.
Pier 21 is feeling a Jamaican groove with a new exhibit.
People are feeling that immigrants are taking away, but in actual fact, many immigrants give.
We'll look at the contributions Jamaican people have made to Nova Scotia.
And later, it's been 100 years since a tragic event at the University of King's College.
The oldest university edifice in the Dominion and one of the most famous on the continent lies in ruin.
Looking back at the fire that brought down the school's original location.
Everyone's familiar with the idea that love is more powerful than hate. Two Halifax conservation groups have decided to show their love for Sandy Lake. The folks at the Ecology Action Center and members of the Sandy Lake Sackville River Park Coalition are sending Valentine cards to three municipal councillors. They want to remind them that people of Halifax love Sandy Lake and want the area protected. Chelsea Clarew reports.
It's amazing.
It's a labor of love with a political end in mind.
Craftivism is about reclaiming the slow process of creating by hand, with thought, with purpose, and with love. Because activism, whether through craft or any other means, is done by individuals, not machines.
That's Charlotte Connolly. She's helping to organize a Valentine's Blitz, starting with an evening of cutting, coloring, and pasting colorful Valentines. So far, 200 to 300 of them are ready for delivery. They'll be hand-delivered to Deputy Mayor Lisa Blackburn, Lower Sackville Councillor Paul Russell, and Downtown Councillor Wei Mason. Carly Mayu Gallant is one of the crafters. She says it's important to protect natural spaces like Sandy Lake.
I went kayaking there before, and I think it's important to protect natural areas.
The area around Sandy Lake already has over 1,000 acres of protected land, but another 1,800 acres is now slotted for development. It's owned by 24 different owners, three large developers and 21 individual landowners. Walter Regan is president of the Sackville Rivers Association.
We really don't need this development. We do need the protection of these wonderful old growth stands, the trees, and stormwater protection to the lake.
Regan says this area right in the middle of Bedford West and Sackville would make a beautiful park for over 60,000 people.
That if we don't keep the chainsaws out and if we don't keep the bulldozers out, we're going to lose a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
The city has offered to buy or swap the land, but Deputy Mayor Lisa Blackburn says one of the major landholders isn't interested. She says HRM is still hoping to buy the surrounding area at least.
This is Simon's Valentine.
Back at the crafters' table, Charlotte Connolly says that's not good enough.
So if this area was developed, it would actually cut off the corridor and create islands of conservation instead of preserving ecological connectivity on the landscape.
Reagan agrees that what is best for the region is for it to remain undeveloped.
We really need to acquire this acreage, one of the few last uncut areas. So almost pristine, we've got to acquire it in public ownership.
The Ecology Action Center is inviting people who are concerned about Sandy Lake to drop by and send Valentine cards. For The Signal, I'm Chelsea Clarew.
A new exhibit at Pier 21 is celebrating a long connection between Nova Scotia and Jamaica. It includes Rastafarian wood carvings and panels that show the history and contributions of Jamaican people in the province. But as Lucia Helder tells us, it's a connection that continues. She visited one family who's brought Jamaican cuisine to Halifax.
Okay, so we're going to get a large jerk chicken, fried green plantains.
For my family, and I'm sure a lot of Caribbean families, you learn it from your relative's kitchen. You learn it from your grandma, your mother, your aunt, your uncle, your grandparents. Like, it's not just one set way to cook in the Caribbean.
Judy Ann Allen runs Brada Jamaican Jerk Joint with her mother and younger sister.
We serve what everybody knows, the famous Jamaican jerk chicken. We have jerk pork, we have curry chicken, but it wouldn't be Jamaican food without the patties, Jamaican patties, so we definitely have that here too.
Her family moved here after she graduated from Mount St. Vincent University. They opened the restaurant last August. Judy Ann and her family are following a long tradition of Jamaicans coming to Nova Scotia. A new exhibit at Pier 21 shows museum goers how Jamaican history has entwined itself with Nova Scotian history. Olive Phillips is the director of the Jamaican Cultural Association of Nova Scotia. She's the driving force behind the project.
And so the whole idea was to show that people are not just immigrants who come here have a lot to offer. But people are feeling that immigrants are taking away, but in actual fact, many immigrants give. And they're unsung heroes.
She and Jamaican historian and poet Dr. Afua Cooper brought stories and research to the team at Pier 21. Dan Conlin is the curator.
Jamaican Cultural Association of Nova Scotia, you know, came up with some real stories that surprised me, you know. All these kind of the biographies of these high-achieving career folks who really demonstrate the contributions that Jamaicans have made to this province, and education and healthcare especially. And so this exhibit really looks at immigration connections, but also cultural connections, and I think a really delightful way.
Back at Brada Jamaican Jerk Joint, Judy Ann Allen is contributing to those connections with authentic meals.
I mean, I'm a little proud when I see them come in and they enjoy the food. So when they come in and they go, yeah, this reminds me of home, I go, yes, thank you.
For The Signal, I'm Lucia Helder.
And here's something to warm you up on a cold February day. This is Jamaican-Canadian artist Ka Riss with Slave to the Memories. That's Ka Riss. She was born in Jamaica and now lives in Ontario. And a birthday note for another Jamaican artist, the father of reggae. Bob Marley would have been 75 this week. You know, his music really holds up still today.
It's so wonderful that his memory lives on through it. Well, this week here at the University of King's College, people were talking about a different kind of heat, a fire.
That's right. This week marked the 100th anniversary of the fire that destroyed the first King's College in Windsor, Nova Scotia. And that resulted in the university eventually moving to its current location here in Halifax. As part of the commemoration, some never-before-seen pictures were revealed this week, and I got an advanced look. Tucked away in a basement room of the King's Library is the University Archive. Second-year student Sophie LaWall is the archive's assistant. She brought me to the archives to see some of the photos taken by a student the day the old campus burned down in Windsor, Nova Scotia, 100 years ago.
And then we also have a photograph album that was taken, of photographs taken by an undergrad student, Ingham Wright Palmer, of the college before the fire, and then also of the college burning. And these photos have some, also show some students and firefighters while the college is burning. So you can see in one of them the spout of water held by the firefighters.
The university marked the anniversary of the fire with a reception for faculty, staff, students, and alumni in the campus bar, the HMCS King's Wardroom. The photos of the fire were displayed around the bar. Janet Hathaway, the university's librarian and archivist, read newspaper clippings from the day after the fire.
Friday, February 6, 1920, a headline, Historic Main Building of Old King's Burnt, the oldest university edifice in the Dominion and one of the most famous on the continent, lies in ruins.
King's vice president, Peter O'Brien, read a description of the event written by an archdeacon of the college at the time.
The college bell, which hung under the portico and had run to summon students to chapel, to lectures, and to meals for over 100 years, sounded its last note when it fell from the flames to the ground below. It used to be heard from Martock, from Tongs Hill, and from Fairfield on the Winkworth Road. Would that its successor might be freed from its restrictions to send forth its sound as far over the waters and hills of Halifax.
Abby, there's a sound we hear every day. That successor bell continues to ring here on campus.
And King's continues its traditions here in Halifax 100 years later. Speaking of traditions, it's King George III Day. For Dal students, it's Monroe Day. What are some of your favorite King's traditions, Dominique?
I think it's probably formal meal. I just like that we have a day where all the students and faculty and people come together on campus and have a meal together.
Especially in those long robes, I always feel like I'm in Harry Potter.
Yeah, it's pretty cool that we still do that here.
My favorite is Matriculation Day. First-year students all get to line up and sign the registry with every other student who's ever gone to the college. It's really special.
Yeah, I remember having to listen to the Latin and having no idea what they were saying.
I decided to do that in 5-inch heels, and I had to walk all the way across the quad. Not great planning in retrospect, but it sure was fun.
That's our show for today.
If there's anything you want to hear again, we'll be posting a link on our social media feeds. Our handle is SignalHFX on Twitter and Instagram.
We'd love to hear from you if you have any thoughts on the show.
Thanks this week to producer Amy Briley and associate producer Madeline Bizzo. Chelsea Clairoux and Lucia Helder are our social media editors.
Thanks to our technician Mark Pinio in the control room.
And our audio professor extraordinaire, Pauline Dakin. I'm Abby Trevino.
And I'm Dominique Amit. We'll be back next week with more stories. Have a great weekend.